From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the late 1940s when a young Noam Chomsky was forming his philosophical beliefs. Chomsky was particularly moved by the work of a man named Eric Arthur Blair, better known for his pen name, George Orwell, author of 1984, among other works. Orwell was a democratic socialist. Chomsky's own political and philosophical beliefs have been well known for decades now, as he's become one of the leading public intellectuals in the country. He's often controversial, not afraid to criticize, particularly when it comes to American foreign policy and military activity. And so I wondered what Chomsky thought of a democratic socialist running for president in 2016 and challenging for the Democratic Party's nomination. Chomsky is coming to Rochester this week as a guest of the University of Rochester to meet with students and faculty. His event this Friday night at the Little Theater is already sold out. You probably don't need me to tell you that Noam Chomsky is the author of more than 100 books. He's a linguist, a scientist, a political dissident, and a social critic. He's kind enough to share some time with me today to talk about the current presidential campaign and its relationship with American foreign and domestic policy. Let me welcome Noam Chomsky to Connections.
Thank you very much.
First of all, throughout your career, you have pointed to the impact of American foreign policy on citizens around the world. But here we are in 2016. We have leading political candidates boasting about making sand glow and carpet bombing. And I wonder if you are dispirited to see that that level of discourse is not disqualifying in a presidential campaign. It is, in fact, an asset in some circles.
Unfortunately, it is, evidently. It is disgraceful. Ted Cruz's comment about carpet bombing has been quite sharply criticized, in particular by the U.S. military, and has led his campaign to qualify it, saying that he didn't really mean that. He just meant intensive bombing of terrorist targets, whatever that's supposed to mean. But the fact that such irresponsible comments are made is very frightening, not just to us, but to the world in general. In fact, though it isn't reported here, there are international polls taken by U.S. polling agencies, Gallup poll, showing that the U.S. is by far regarded as the greatest threat to world peace by a very large majority. Nobody else is even close. And comments, and that's during the, you know, a couple of years ago, looking at if a poll was taken today, listening to these comments, I think it would be much worse.
President Obama decided that he did not have to send ground troops or airstrikes on Syria back in 2013, despite drawing a so-called red line on chemical weapons. He recently told Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic that the foreign policy establishment is obsessed with building credibility, and the main way to build credibility is to drop bombs. Do you agree with his assessment there?
Yeah, I think he's correct. There is a sense that by dropping bombs, we somehow establish, by using force, in other words, we establish credibility. What we actually establish is fear and anger. In fact, we see it pretty clearly. Take the so-called war on terror, which George Bush declared, actually redeclared on 2001. At that time, the terrorist forces that we were concerned with, Al-Qaeda, were confined to a very small area in the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And with proper policies, they could have been eliminated. Instead, we have repeatedly resorted to the sledgehammer attack approach. And the result we can see. By now, the Al-Qaeda affiliates and even worse offshoots like ISIS are over much of the world, from Southeast Asia to West Africa, all through the Levant, carrying out actions in Europe. Every time you strike the system with force, you increase the level of resentment, anger, desire for revenge, and terrorist activities. Take, say, the invasion of Iraq, the worst crime of this century, surely. Among other things, it led to a sharp increase in terrorism. That had actually been predicted by intelligence agencies, but it was much worse than they expected. Terrorist acts increased by a factor of 7 just in the first year. Take the bombing of Libya. It not only virtually destroyed Libya, but it led to a flood of jihadis and weapons all over large parts of Africa, the Middle East. By now, the worst terrorist actions anywhere in the world in scale are in West Africa, substantially a result of the bombing of Libya and its consequences. The belief that this establishes credibility is mind-boggling. The same is true of the drone assassination programs, which are regarded as just plain terrorism in much of the world. You might be interested in an article that just appeared in the British press by a peace activist in Afghanistan who describes how he's on the kill list. Everywhere he goes, there's an attempt to assassinate him with drones, usually killing lots of other people, so far missing him. He finally says in the article, "Well, why don't you just kill me while I'm here in England?" That's the way we'd react. I mean, suppose we were walking around on the street and we didn't know whether 5 minutes from now a couple of guys standing across the street will be blown away, along with anyone who happens to be near them, because somebody thinks they're a potential threat. We'd be terrorized. And that's happening in large areas of the world. And it creates terrorists. If you take a look at the horrible atrocities in Brussels and Paris, for which ISIS took responsibility, but they actually did state their reasons. They said their reasons were basically, if you bomb us, we'll attack you. Well, it's horrible atrocities, awful crimes, but we can hardly say that we don't understand them.
Well, and I know you have heard the arguments from those who say that is too much of a false equivalence, et cetera, and that ISIS is going to be interested in striking civilians and killing innocents, no matter what our actions are. And so what would be, you know, the Jeffrey Goldberg interview with Obama carried the title The Obama Doctrine. If there were a Chomsky doctrine, what would it say toward dealing with ISIS, for example?
First of all, we don't, in the cases of the actual atrocities, they have been specifically linked to military attacks. So the bombing of the Russian airliner in Egypt, for which ISIS took responsibility, was a direct response, the reaction they claimed to Russian bombings. Same with the bombing in Ankara. Same with Brussels and Paris. But the approach that I would take is the one that is actually recommended by the leading U.S. government and other specialists on the topic. You have to if you want to deal with ISIS or other, which happens to be a monstrosity, and other al-Nusra, the affiliate of al-Qaeda in Syria, you have to understand where they're coming from. You have to understand the roots and deal with the roots of the problem. We understand that to some extent. There's a lot of research into why young Westerners, many of them are flocking to the jihadi cause. These are people, say, who live in the slums of Paris or slums of Brussels, who are subjected to degradation, humiliation, have no opportunities in their lives, want to find something, as young people do. Okay, deal with the problem where it begins. The roots of ISIS happen to be in the invasion of Iraq. Well, we can't do anything more about that, but we can I think it makes good sense to give military support to the groups that are defending themselves against ISIS, to the ground forces, to the people who say pretty much rescued the Yazidi. Those are mostly Kurds, and they happen to be the main target of our ally Turkey. But to prevent Turkish attacks on them and to support them would, I think, be a reasonable policy. There are lots of things that can be done. The main thing that can be done is to try to resolve, to the extent possible, the war in Syria. And finally, there are some steps in that direction. There are temporary, maybe permanent, I hope, ceasefires. They're the beginnings of negotiations. The United States has dropped its demand that the Assad regime essentially commit suicide, that it not be party to negotiations, which, of course, they're never going to do. So now they're a party in the negotiations. They're a hideous regime, but the choices are either allowing them to be part of the negotiations or destroying Syria. And given those choices, it only makes sense to allow them to be part of the negotiations. Now, the U.S. is also reluctantly, but finally, allowing Iran perhaps to join, which it certainly should do. They're a participant. These moves could offer really the only slim hope for resolving the Syrian conflict before almost total destruction of the country. And they should be pursued vigorously, along with support for those resisting ISIS, like the Kurds, dealing with the sources of jihadism, the roots of them in Western Europe and, in fact, in the Middle East as well. We have to face the fact, much as we might not like it, that ISIS has support from Sunni populations in Iraq and Syria, in part because of the, in large part, they may hate ISIS, but they still often support it because the alternatives that they see are worse. Well, we can try to deal with that situation. All of that is much less exciting than carpet bombing, but it's a way to deal with the problem instead of expanding the problem.
And right now, as you say, there is certainly a growing industry of people who are trying to figure out what drives young men, mostly young men, to join ISIS. Here's one idea that I hear often, and I'm curious about your view of it. In most holy books, not just the Quran, certainly not just the Quran, of course, there are passages that could be viewed as calling for violence of some kind. And so the argument goes that as long as religion exists, there will be some non-zero part of the population that interprets those passages literally and carries out violence with the mindset of religious authenticity. What do you make of that?
Well, there are two points to be made. One is, you're correct that there's a lot of very significant research going on into the motivation and the nature of the people who are joining the jihadis. Turns out that Islam is a very minor part of it. Most of them have very little background in Islam. They're drawn to the idea of an Islamic caliphate and defending Muslims against attack, but not because of passages in the Quran or the Hadith, which they barely know. You know, there's excellent research on this, among others by the group run by Scott Atran, who's at the University of Michigan and in Paris. And this is what's found consistently. The second point is that if you want to look for violent passages, you can't go beyond the Old Testament, which has some of the most genocidal passages in the whole literary canon. And that's the holy book for all the Abrahamic religions, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. But do we therefore say that Christianity is a source of extreme violence? I mean, it certainly has been through its history, and in fact, even today, when George Bush invaded Iraq, one of his comments was that he was following the commands of his Lord. I don't know to what extent that was a personal motive for him, but maybe it was. However, again, if you want to look for violent, murderous, genocidal passages, there's almost nothing that compares with the Old Testament.
My guest for a few more minutes is Noam Chomsky. And turning domestically, Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig tried to run for president as a Democrat in this election cycle, but he was essentially shut out of the debates by the Democratic Party all throughout the fall and leading into this winter. He wanted to make campaign finance reform his singular focus because he argues that money has utterly overwhelmed American politics with corruption. Did you observe the way the Democratic Party kind of froze Lawrence Lessig out of the debates? Did you have a view of that action?
Yeah, I think that's part of the way it goes back to a fundamental feature of American politics. We have a two-party system with a winner-take-all approach as distinct from proportional representation. Most countries, most democracies have some form of proportional representation, which means that there's an opening for smaller parties within the parliamentary system. They have representatives, they have access, they can develop their programs, and they can often become a majority. Our system doesn't allow that. It's restricted to, you know, first past the post and the two establishment parties. That's a pretty sharp restriction, which in my view is a serious flaw of the parliamentary system that we have. I think there are ways around it, which are sometimes used, like fusion candidates. In some states that's permitted, I think New York, a few others, meaning you can vote for the minority party that represents your views, and the votes are counted for the establishment party that you prefer to the other. That's a kind of technical way around the restrictions of the that our version of parliamentary system imposes. And the shutting out of Lawrence Lessig is one aspect of this. I mean, the Greens are shut out as well, so Jill Stein isn't given a position on the debates.
Sure. And, you know, when it comes to the two-party system that you refer to, Bernie Sanders, who is persevering in this race and might not have the delegates to eventually win it, but he certainly wants to try, he calls himself a Democratic Socialist. Socialism is a term that might scare some voters, and surely the Republican Party would use it against Sanders in a general election. How do you view his political ideology?
His political ideology is pretty straight New Deal Democrats. In fact, his positions wouldn't have surprised President Eisenhower. It's just that the general spectrum has shifted so far to the right that what used to be mainstream policies have become are regarded as radical. So, for example, his call for national health care. I mean, that's been, first of all, it's a perfectly reasonable approach. Every other developed society has it, and much more effective than ours. And it's also the position supported by a considerable majority of the population for a long time. So much so that in the Reagan years, about 70% of the population thought it ought to be constitutionally guaranteed. It's hardly a radical position. Again, someone like Eisenhower would have considered it entirely within the mainstream. In fact, Eisenhower himself said that anyone who does not accept New Deal programs doesn't belong in our political system. That's now considered a radical stand. But that has to do with the shift of the spectrum of political and economic and socioeconomic life since the last generation, mostly since Reagan.
We have found that supporters of Hillary Clinton tend to say that Clinton and Bernie Sanders agree on most issues, and that Clinton is more able to accomplish those goals in Washington. But we find that Sanders supporters tend to say that he is pushing for systemic change far beyond what Hillary Clinton wants. Do you view their goals as essentially similar or having significant differences?
I think there are significant differences, we should recognize that, say, if I should say Sanders stands or closer to what I would prefer than Clinton's. If he were elected, which doesn't look too likely, but if he were elected, he would not be able to implement his goals without a massive popular movement supporting it. There'd be virtually no legislative support. No little support in the bureaucracy, state legislatures, governors, and so on. The whole framework of policy implementation would not be probably not supportive of his positions. So unless his campaign leads to an ongoing, dedicated popular movement that continues to press for policy decisions after the election, not just keyed to the election, but constant and continuing, unless that develops, he probably wouldn't be able to do much, even if he were elected.
You have said that the American right is more concerning than the European right because the American right has the actual capacity to accelerate the destruction of this planet. And that's related to climate change and corporate interest in maintaining the status quo, inhibiting significant reforms with energy and consumption. And I'm curious to know if you think the right truly believes that climate change is mythical, or if you think the right knows it's a problem and doesn't care.
Well, we only know what the candidates say. Almost all of them just simply flatly deny that it's happening, or if it's happening, that humans have anything to do with it. One candidate, Kasich, says, yeah, it's happening, but then he goes on to say we shouldn't do anything about it. Well, that's basically, it's almost like a death knell for the species. And it's not anything remote. It's having an impact right now. So, for example, last December, there was an international conference in Paris attempting to achieve an international commitment among the countries of the world to deal with the problem, the dreadful problem of emissions. And they were hoping to achieve a binding treaty, but they couldn't for one reason, the Republican Congress. That was quite explicit. They couldn't achieve a treaty because the Republican Congress would not accept it, a Republican-led Congress. Therefore, they had to settle for voluntary agreements, which are, of course, much weaker. If a Republican were to be elected, and if they actually mean what they say, then the world is in deep trouble for this reason alone.
I guess to some degree, the distinction between whether climate change is mythical or knows it's a problem and doesn't care doesn't really matter.
Actually, it comes out the same. If they just believe it's a myth, you can accuse them of astonishing ignorance. If they know it's not a myth and are nevertheless denying it, you can accuse them of real criminality. They're saying, look, we know our policies are going to undermine the prospects for decent survival, but we don't care.
One listener question, and that question comes from a listener named Jake, who says, Evan, please ask about neurotheology and where Mr. Chomsky thinks analytical philosophy is going over the coming decades with technological advances.
Where analytic philosophy is going to go is a long topic, but I can't go into that, but as far as technological advances are concerned, I suspect what the caller has in mind are the alleged achievements of artificial intelligence, deep learning, big data, and so on. And my feeling is that most of that is hype, public relations. I mean, you can develop useful devices. So robots, that's fine. It'd be nice to have useful robots. It'd be nice to have maybe self-driving cars. But understanding anything about human intelligence, or even such simple, apparently simple things as, you know, the decision to, say, raise your finger or shift your eye gaze, is totally out of range of any of these approaches. Anything, my own particular area of interest, especially language, there's just almost no contributions. You know, a Google Translator is useful. I sometimes use it. But it's telling you nothing about the nature of language or human intelligence. So as far as analytic philosophy is concerned, or our general concerns as just human beings, I think these are kind of engineering achievements, which, to the extent that they're useful, are fine, but are not of any fundamental intellectual significance or providing any substantial insight into human nature, human intelligence, the deep problems that we'd like to have some understanding of.
It sounds like you don't think technology could ever get there, especially when it comes to language. I mean, is there any development that could happen that would change your opinion of that?
Well, I think technology can do a lot. So, for example, the use of big data, what's called big data, you know, massive storage of data, rapid computation, that can be quite useful in testing hypotheses. That's standard science. So I've nothing against technology. I think it's fine. But the fundamental problems are have to be investigated the way they always have been in the history of science, by trying to develop theoretical principles that can yield potential explanations, and then testing them against the evidence that we can accumulate. There's no other way to proceed, I don't think. And how far this can go is not very clear. We should bear in mind that human beings are not angels. We're organic creatures. And as such, we have a certain scope to our abilities and conceptual range, but we also have limits. And there's examples of that in history.
Noam Chomsky, a great pleasure to talk to you. And I know the University of Rochester is thrilled to have you this week. Thank you for making time for the program, and we will see you in Rochester.
Thank you very much.
After this short break, we'll talk to students and faculty at the University of Rochester about Noam Chomsky's upcoming visit. Coming up in our second hour, the mathematics of voting, particularly the power of small groups when it comes to influencing outcomes. Who does have the power? Who doesn't? We'll take a look at delegates, the Electoral College, and more with a leading mathematical professor. It's all next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Turning Stone Resort and Casino, offering getaways including lodging, dining, and spa treatments. Details and event information available online at turningstone.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I want to remind you that Noam Chomsky's event at the Little Theater on Friday is sold out. So, unfortunately, don't call the Little Theater looking for extra tickets there. It's an event that, as you can imagine, sold out very quickly. He's also talking to students and faculty at the University of Rochester, and I've invited some of them in for the rest of the hour to talk about the visit of Noam Chomsky and some of his work and his career. So let me go ahead and introduce them now. One student on the panel, Jesse Bernstein's a student, and Jesse, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Nice to see you, too.
Ted Brown's a professor of history, medical humanities, and public health and policy at the University of Rochester. Ted, nice to see you.
Good to be here.
And Jeff Runner is a professor and chair of the Department of Linguistics at the University of Rochester. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
Jeff, I want to start with you. When it comes to linguistics, we got just a little bit at the end of that conversation, but this is the part that, to some degree, I think Chomsky's career, recent career, his social activism, his political dissident work, you know, in your world, it doesn't overshadow his linguistics work. Maybe to the general public it does. What do you think the public doesn't know about his work with linguistics that they probably should?
Well, I think one thing that Chomsky's most
sort of famous for, especially within our world of linguistics and cognitive science, is his claim about universal grammar, the idea that there's a shared innate system that all humans have and that other primates and other animals don't have. And from that idea, there's still a lot of controversy about whether that is really the right way to look at language or not. And certainly that comment he made about big data sort of bears on that, because the sort of the big data angle is this idea that if you looked at enough data, maybe you could actually somehow find the structures that are underlying language, and you wouldn't actually need to posit the claim that the grammar is actually innate. So there's still this discussion of big data still kind of fits in with his original work on universal grammar.
And in the field of linguistics, that idea on its own is viewed as pretty revolutionary, isn't it? I mean, in the ways that Einstein and other great minds kind of opened up new ideas of thought, yes?
Sure. That's true, definitely. No matter where you are in the sort of spectrum of beliefs in linguistics, you're influenced by these claims by Chomsky. And there's many people that are absolutely committed to the idea of universal grammar, and a lot of their work is about figuring out how that actually works. And then there's a lot of people who are interested in looking at other ways of deriving what looks like universal grammar. So one of the claims, one of the pieces of evidence for universal grammar is something like the fact that there are language universals, that are certain similarities across languages, suggesting that there's something common across all humans.
For example,
I mean, this is a very obscure one, but so for a language like English, we have prepositions. So we have prepositions like on coming before their nouns. In a language like Japanese, you have postpositions. These little words come after the nouns. Well, typically languages that have prepositions also have verbs coming before their nouns, and languages that have postpositions have their verbs coming after their nouns. So there's certain cross-linguistic similarities. That's called a linguistic implication, actually. That suggests there is some sort of similar system underlying language. But we don't know. So the part about the UG hypothesis that some people are sort of still struggling with, let's say, is the claim that it's specifically to language and that specifically to humans. So it could be that there are language processing capabilities or language learning information learning capabilities that humans have that are true of all humans because we're humans, and that ends up resulting in what looks like language. So this isn't necessarily a view I hold, but there's definitely that view out there. Some of my colleagues at the University of Rochester in brain and cognitive sciences, for example, are very interested in pursuing that approach. So the question is, to what degree can we explain what's similar across languages without positing a language particular universal grammar, but actually say, well, we know we're all humans and we have certain kinds of abilities to process information. Maybe this actually is what underlies the similarities across human languages.
And for listeners who haven't heard of even the idea of universal grammar, if Chomsky is right, what's the impact? Why does it matter?
Well, what does it matter? It matters because it gives us an idea of it gives us a very particular feature of humans that would be claimed not to be true of other species. And the particular view of universal grammar that Chomsky holds is that there's really kind of like a small, like a computer program in our heads that is specifically constructing abstract representations of structures that then, when a child is exposed to words in their environment, they tack on these words to these structures. So these structures would actually be part of the human mind, even for children. That's a fascinating claim about what children are bringing to the job of language acquisition.
All right, Ted Brown, from what you heard in that conversation, what stands out to you?
Well, what I heard was a number of statements by Chomsky that are quite similar to those he's made in many, many of his books. And I've been involved with a group of graduate students and faculty who have been reading as many of his books as we've been able to this semester, which is really a very small portion of his total production. It's immense. And some claims he made in his interview that he also makes in his books that we've grappled with are that the United States is the greatest threat to world peace, for example, that the drone program represents a form of assassination, and in some places he has even called President Obama assassin-in-chief, to make his point. He talks about the Iraq War as the greatest crime of the 21st century and so, and made various claims about Eisenhower's presidency and positions he supported and so on. So part of what we've been doing in our discussions and getting ready for our discussion with him live later this week is to interrogate some of those claims and to try to feel to decide how we feel about them so that we can get him to either defend them or provide some other more nuanced interpretation or the like. But we were also interested in other sorts of things. He has a very powerful perspective that hasn't been applied to issues that are current in our own political environment now. Part of our time has been to find issues that we would like to put before him to see how he would comment on them. For example, what does he think about the Black Lives Matter movement, and how does that relate to his earlier commitments, passionate commitments to the civil rights movement? What does he think, for example, about Donald Trump on a political scene? We've heard him talk about Bernie Sanders and about Ted Cruz, but what about Donald Trump and the view that he often states in his book, and he almost said in the interview, that the political establishment is actually far more conservative, far more to the right than the American public. If you judge by polls, the American public has more progressive views. Well, then what does Donald Trump represent if that is, in fact, an empirically justified claim? It certainly seems that a good part of the American public isn't to the left of the political establishment, but maybe to the right. Let's look at that. And there are other views that we'd like him to talk about as well. But we're also interested, and I'm fascinated, by what makes him tick. How did someone who achieved such great significance in the field of linguistics, where he shifted the discussion and the intellectual activity in the field, perhaps to the same extent as Einstein shifted discussions in physics, as you said in your portion of the interview, how would someone like that then decide in the late 1960s to become the major dissident and public intellectual that he did, and to go on and to have another career, at least as prolific as his career in linguistics, which had major personal consequences for him, consequences in his personal life, consequences he faced at least temporary incarceration. He was on trial. He withheld half of his tax contribution in protest to the Vietnam War, and that had its consequences. And so on. Why would someone of his intellectual eminence, his towering intellectual eminence, also engage in current political issues and be such a dissident? What inspired him? What autobiographical factors, what personal factors motivated him and kept him going? These are among the questions that we're most interested in.
I referenced the interview that Barack Obama did with Jeffrey Goldberg for The Atlantic called The Obama Doctrine. And the biggest surprise I had in that interview that spanned 20,000 words was a very little emphasis on drones. Goldberg didn't really press much. It only came up, and of course the president sort of defended and tried to justify that portion of his foreign policy choices. But yeah, I was surprised by that. I would like to see the president speak at length more about it, and certainly Noam Chomsky has said plenty about that.
Yes, he has.
But he referenced that. Ted, did you have anything surprise you in what he said about Bernie Sanders and his view that Bernie Sanders is really more of a New Deal Democrat as opposed to a Democratic Socialist?
I wasn't surprised by that because I've already heard an interview in which he said exactly that. And I think to some extent it is true. But Chomsky's own positions are far to the left of whatever Sanders has stated.
Sure.
And I think that's the principal distinction he was drawing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jesse Bernstein, a student who, listening to that interview, first of all, what stands out to you?
What stands out to me is sort of the breadth and depth of his knowledge. I'm always blown away listening to the wide range of things he can speak about. I have a couple friends. We have a running joke to see how many different courses he'll come up in over the course of a semester. I'm also kind of interested in him as sort of a dying breed of the public intellectual in a way that he describes so much in the essay that you interviewed him about, the responsibility of the intellectual. I just think it's a sort of person that is doesn't exist as much as it used to, in a way that a radical political activist could also be someone as part of a educational establishment, in a way that would allow them to make the sort of statements that he makes. There aren't a whole lot of Noam Chomsky's running around, and I think especially with the death of Christopher Hitchens a couple years ago. I think that's just a sort of person that isn't around to the extent that Chomsky is.
Sure. And, you know, it was, I think it was last year that one of Hitchens' friends and fellow new atheists, Sam Harris, had an extended email dialogue with Noam Chomsky, and Chomsky was not impressed with Sam Harris in that dialogue, and Harris was disappointed with some of the outcomes because Chomsky viewed it as almost not worth his time. But perhaps with the death of people like Hitchens, and Chomsky's 87 now, you wonder who else is sort of in that category, right, Jesse? I mean, I'm trying to think of who else would be in that category.
Weirdly, the people who have, I think, slipped into that category are the Stuarts and Colberts of the world have become our liberal public intellectuals, and even public intellectuals in general. You know, I think the right has lost it as much as the left. You know, we're not in an age of William F. Buckley anymore. You know, we're in an age of Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh. And so it's almost needed to come in disguised as comedy in order to become that liberal public intellectual that perhaps Chomsky represents the last of, or
well,
hopefully not.
And you know, I think, and I want to direct this question at Ted, I think, what maybe someone like Chomsky gets annoyed with, and I probably think justifiably so, is that he spends some of his time defending himself against charges of anti-Americanism, you know, which sort of is a way to distill so much of his argument down to, you either wave our flag or you know, you're either an apologist for us or you are against us. And obviously his views are much more complex than that. I heard in the interview today, for those who have claimed that he is an ISIS apologist or an Islamic-based terror apologist, I heard him very clearly talk about how awful those groups are and what could be done to eradicate them, as opposed to simply saying that it is our fault, though he also probably inflamed some who don't like hearing his view that ISIS's attacks, he looks at Brussels, he looks at Paris, are direct responses to activity there. So I guess my point is it's so much more complex than saying he's anti-American or he's not, and yet that's where a lot of it ends up going down to.
His views are very subtle, very complex, always very well reasoned. He sees himself as someone dispassionately bringing facts to bear on statements that have been made in the public domain or by others. He sees himself as someone who is interrogating questions and adding levels of nuance. And when he gets criticized with broadsides like anti-Americanism, or sometimes his views on Israel are considered anti-Semitic, which is absurd, especially given his biographical tradition and how important Judaism has been for him during his life and how important in an early stage of his life Zionism was for him. He sees these views, these broadside attacks, as essentially versions of Stalinism. He calls them that directly. And he himself, though he is strongly on the left, has always avoided Stalinist, rigid, hierarchical Marxism, sees himself more as a libertarian socialist or as an anarchist, proudly using that term, always of independent judgment, and that's what his work is about. He will reach his own independent judgment on his own way, in his own way, on his own time, with carefully marshaled facts and arguments, and others may hurl invective against them and issue broadsides, but he's going to sort of shrug them off and move forward.
One of my concerns, and had I more time, well, I had a list of about 1,000 questions I would have liked had I more time. But one of them is just how he now views, at his age and having his experience, how do you elevate the discourse in this country to at least get to the point where, and again, I'm not choosing any political side here. I'm just saying when you use terms like make sand glow, that's not a nuanced argument. That's not attempting to understand you know, complexities of a world that a part of our world that's very different than our own. How do we get to a discourse in this country that at least puts a value on appreciating complexity? Because right now there's not a value on that. It's short sound bites, as Jesse said. It's the age of cable news, and you know, we're kind of going away from embracing complexity. And I don't know how you get back to that. I'd be curious to hear what he would say. What do you think, Ted?
I don't know. It's a question we'd like to ask him. When you do ask him for sources of optimism, because his views on politics seem to be very pessimistic, heading in a downward arc, but yet he affirms optimism and talks in glowing ways about some of the people who have been close to him, important to him, like Howard Zinn, and others who have influenced him personally. He also talks about various movements, such as the World Social Forum, the Global South, liberation movements, movements for women's rights, and so on, which deeply move him emotionally. He's not just a man of the intellect. He is also a man of passion and emotion, though he tries to keep that contained in his encounters. And I think, oddly, he turns to the next generation of younger people who are mobilizing around broad issues of morality and deep social principle as a source for his own continuing inspiration. I suppose he would hope that he would be able to ally with such groups and begin a careful conversation with them, enjoying their passion, appreciating their morality, and wanting to discuss with them a more analytical approach to some of the issues they're taking on.
You heard Ted Brown mention what he would like to ask Noam Chomsky. I want to ask Jesse and Jeff the same question. Jesse, if you get a chance to talk to Noam Chomsky at the University of Rochester, what is on your mind first and foremost for him?
I want to speak to him about his book, Manufacturing Consent. That's obviously published in 1988. That's his great tome on the conglomerate of major media corporations coming together to manufacture consent, as he says. But I want to talk to him about what he thinks the internet has done either to subvert that manufacturing or to perhaps even strengthen it. I'm interested to hear what he thinks. The democratization of media, which I think ties into the sort of the cable news that we were talking about, but also has to do with people being able to either make their own news or find their own news in a way that they weren't able to before. So whether or not he believes that has been beneficial to people who are trying to get the truth, you know, quote unquote, the truth, whatever that means, or whether it has impeded it even greater, that ability.
And Jeff Runner brings us back to Chomsky's earlier career as a linguist. So, you know, it is so interesting to Ted's point about how this is somebody who can have such huge impact in careers that are, you know, in totally different realms. But for you, Jeff, what would you want to ask Noam Chomsky?
I'm very interested in the research that has suggested that humans, including children, are able to actually sort of learn and acquire very complex systems of data that sort of starts arguing against his sort of poverty of the stimulus argument that he's made in the past about how it's not possible that children could actually acquire language without having some sort of innate structures because the kind of data they're exposed to is just so limited and it doesn't have the kind of complexity that we would need. But there's been a lot of research over the last 10 or 15 years showing that kids especially are capable of processing and learning all sorts of very interesting structures. Now, whether or not those structures are going to ultimately turn into the kinds of structures that we ultimately would need to explain sort of innate, the supposedly innate grammar is another question, but that's something I'd like to hear his reaction to.
Let me sneak in one listener phone call and got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Bruce and Irondequoit.
And I hear what you guys are all saying about trying to quiet dissenting voices and like that, and that's not appropriate. But when I heard him speak in regards to, well, ISIS attacked Egypt because they got bombed by Russia, or they attacked Belgium because of what we've done, we didn't go after them to begin with before they started attacking Iraq and these other places. So, you know, quiet voices like that, but I didn't hear him fully go back through that process and saying, well, it's our own fault. We went and did this. Well, if you go back through it, you know, on a chicken and egg it goes all the way back to what ISIS did originally. So in all that conversation, sometimes people have to be held to test for simplistic types of things. Well, they're attacking us because we attacked them. Well, we attacked them because they attacked us. So it just was a point in when I was listening to him that kind of, you know, well, you know, it's nice to have an opinion, and it's nice to put on and have a well, you know, thought out type of strategy, but you have to take that back through the different pieces. And I just would have liked him to explore that more. It was kind of simplistic.
Sure.
And didn't really explore the whole question.
Bruce, thanks for the phone call. You know, I was struck by some of those comments as well. I mean, it implies at least that if we were to sort of disengage from that part of the world, especially militarily, that ISIS might cease entirely their aggression toward Western targets, or at least us. And that's hard to believe. And I understand that there are many who view, like Chomsky says, that Islam is only a very small part of the motivation. There are those like Sam Harris who disagree with that, and they've had those conversations with Chomsky that you can, those dialogues you can find online. But Bruce, I appreciate the point, and it's an interesting part of the conversation. So as we wrap here, I want to thank our panel for coming in and sharing their thoughts on Chomsky. Ted Brown, want to remind listeners, I mean, I wish they could see Chomsky this week. You guys will get to see him. The brief look at the schedule this week.
Right.
What's coming up with Noam Chomsky this week?
He's giving a public, there's a film about his work primarily focusing on his linguistics. It's an animated film. Chomsky will comment on the film. This is available to the public. It's on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock on campus. And then he's giving another major talk on campus at 5 o'clock on Thursday, which seating, I guess, is first come, first serve in the Interfaith Chapel on campus. So these will be two good opportunities where he'll be able to respond. And if you can score a ticket somehow to Little, that would be another major event.
Which is sold out. But again, so you got Wednesday, you got Thursday, and those events online. The podcast for this program, which will be up this afternoon, we'll post links if you want to check out more information on them. But as Ted said, get there early if you'd like to. There'll be a lot of interest. Our thanks to Ted Brown. Nice to see you, Ted. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jeff Runner, professor and chair of the Department of Linguistics at U of R. Thank you, Jeff. Nice seeing you. And Jesse Bernstein, good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're an impressive student. I bet you every professor would love to have someone as engaged as you. Short break. We're talking about the mathematics of voting next.